One of my best loved Bible stories from childhood was the tale of Gideon. And I'm sure we all know the basic story rather well. However, the quirk about stories like this one is that we often retain a partial image in our minds based on two limiting factors. Number one, we heard a limited or watered down version of this when we were ch children. And then two, it's also our fleshly nature that we tend to retain only the really visual parts and not a lot else. So I thought it would be interesting to take some time to revisit the story with you today to refresh our memories about the details and perhaps find a few pictures that you haven't inside there that you haven't considered recently. So we're going to lay out our thoughts in three parts. When and where is this story taking place? What are the circumstances? Who was Gideon? Why was he the one here in the story? And then the events of the confrontation and battle and its aftermath. So there are a few details we can determine pretty quickly. For example, at the time our story occurs, the tribes are scattered across the promised land. So we know that this is after the Exodus, after the Hebrews entered the land to claim it, and after it was divided amongst the tribes by Joshua, according to the instructions that God provided to him. But since this is the period of the judges, we also know these events take place before the time of the kings, beginning with King Saul. Given a lack of specific dates or easy to pinpoint facts, one estimate of the timing of the events of the judges places them between 1200 BC and 1020 BC, a span of approximately 180 years. Now, this is based upon evidence for the arrival of the Israelites into the Promised Land, as well as some best guesses for the beginning of the reign of Saul. So this is not exact. It's worth pointing out that if we were to add all the time periods that are actually mentioned in Judges, you obtain a number somewhere between 410 and 430 years. Now, this doesn't seem to fit together, so the best answer that I've come across is that these are not all events that are laid end to end sequentially, but rather they overlap sometimes during a similar period, but in different areas within the land. Again, without concrete archaeological evidence, and this is very limited because these are not high-profile governmental events, dating is really difficult and perhaps impossible. For a few interesting reference points, because I always like to position this with some other details. It is believed, for example, that the Trojan War took place around this span of time, and we also know that the Iron Age began in 1100 BC in Austria, and with the development of iron spreading through Europe. I always like to know what's going on around the world sometimes during these stories. Furthermore, there's evidence that a volcano erupted in Iceland in this approximate time frame with an explosion 7 times greater than that of Mount St. Helens back in 1980. This is actually an interesting potential link to climate change in, at that time period. That large of an explosion would have actually affected the climate. And we expect that there would have been weather patterns that were affected, which could have caused droughts, famines, population movement. And that population movement, we think, is actually related to the story of Gideon. Because we know that in the midst of all this, the Midianites had come to the land inhabited by the Israelites, and life was very difficult as a result. We read in Judges 6, 1 through 6, "Then the sons of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord gave them into the hands of Midian 7 years. The power of Midian prevailed against Israel. Because of Midian, the sons of Israel made for themselves the dens which were in the mountains and caves and the strongholds. For it was when Israel had sown that the Midianites would come up with the Amalekites and the sons of the east and go against them. So they would camp against them and destroy the produce of the earth as far as Gaza and leave no sustenance in Israel, as well as no sheep, ox, or donkey. For they would come up with their livestock and their tents. They would come in like locusts for number. Both they and their camels were innumerable, and they came into the land to devastate it. So Israel was brought very low because of Midian, and the sons of Israel cried to the Lord. Time after time, God's chosen people fell into the same traps and temptations. Even at the end of the book of Judges, after all these amazing stories of God's deliverance, we're told in those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. This is an interesting passage because it can be read in two ways. The first way, the obvious way, is that this was a time of every man for himself. Or you might even describe it as survival of the fittest. We might imagine this was a period something close to anarchy. Or it might be likened to the present day, wherein we're all casting about and looking for the way to be. We're all trying to figure things out. And some of us are letting the flesh rule and seeking personal gain. Or even if not that, maybe we're just focused on losing less than our neighbor. Others are perhaps trying to do the right thing, but we know even then we're going to fail because we're imperfect. And if you doubt this, just look at all the attempts that are made to fix our political structure, our economy, our education, our healthcare system. We don't have perfect solutions. So we imagine that life was made more difficult in their day due to the lack of structure and leadership. Furthermore, we could also imagine that one of the primary lessons for the Hebrews in keeping and in reading the book of Judges was this need for a leader and a guide. Some might think that meant a king, like Saul, but even that didn't work out very well for them. The better conclusion was not the need for a human king, but rather the need for the ultimate Lord of all, their God. But I promised you a second way to read that passage. No king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. We can also imagine this as a foreshadowing of the ultimate goal for all mankind. We look forward to and pray for that day when God's promise from Jeremiah 31 will come to pass. Jeremiah 31, verses 33 through 34. But this is the covenant which I will make with the house of Israel after those days, declares the Lord. I will put my law within them, and on their heart I will write it, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. They will not teach again, each man his neighbor and each man his brother, saying, Know the Lord, for they will all know. They will all know me, from the least of them to the greatest of them, declares the Lord. For I will forgive their iniquity, and their sin I will remember no more. Now, even though Israel had forgotten their promises to God when they first were granted entry into the promised land, nothing provides a better reminder than that moment when everything is against you. And so the Midianites came like locusts, and the Israelites called out to God because of their suffering, and his response in Judges 6, verses 7 through 10, was essentially, You brought this on yourselves. But then an angel of the Lord came to Gideon. Why Gideon? We don't have a great deal of background provided for Gideon. We do know he was the son of Joash, the Abiezrite, and we know that he came from a clan of Manasseh. There's also reason to suspect the division of the land that was described in the book of Joshua, where each tribe goes gets a certain region, was actually more theoretical than the reality. Some scholars point out that the ideal picture of the 12 tribes, each in its own place, seems to have never completely materialized. And the blame for this would be the failure of the nation to complete the conquest of Canaan, as commanded by God. Because of this incomplete conquest, the remainder of the tribes were often forced to defend themselves against their neighbors, and in some cases were forced to migrate away from the region that had been promised to them. And this, in turn, created a great deal of religious and moral pressure on the Israelites. They were living around and among Canaanites. They were exposed to their customs and their religion. With constant exposure came more and more opportunity to bend just a little, to adopt the belief in the polytheism of the Canaanites, which led to something called syncretism. Now, you may not be familiar with the word, but you are definitely familiar with the consequences. We live with the consequences of syncretism today. For example, why do we have a tree at Christmas? Well, pagans used to burn a huge Yule log when celebrating the winter solstice. That's syncretism. We pull it, it gets pulled in and associated with Christian themes. It's why our celebration of the resurrection is called Easter, originally Ishtar, the Assyrian and Babylonian goddess of fertility. The reason we think of eggs and bunnies, because bunnies breed like rabbits. In similar fashion, the pagan belief and traditions crept in and corrupted those pure beliefs of the Israelites. Therefore, throughout the book of Judges, what we find is a mixture of tribes and a mixture of Canaanites that are influencing them. There's no doubt this contribution, that this contributes to the state of things, and then that's why they needed the judges to remind the people of their one true God. So, while Gideon was certainly from a clan of Manasseh, were it not positive he actually lived in the region that we assume is the region of Manasseh? If we look up Ophrah, which is central to this story, we find no concrete record of such a city in Manasseh. There were two cities by that name in Ephraim and Benjamin, neither of which seems to fit the events of this story geographically. And so the best guess of some historians, at least, is that the city in question was actually found in or very near Issachar, which is near the Valley of Jezreel. And that's really all we can do is formulate a best guess about this. But it's a really intriguing guess, and it makes a lot of sense for our story. For one thing, the Jezreel Valley has another name you might be familiar with, the Valley of Megiddo. It's commonly agreed its location was of great strategic importance. It was located at the crossroads of two common military and trade routes, one between Egypt and Mesopotamia, the other connecting Jerusalem with cities of Phoenicia. So it's an important region, a region an army would have wished to control. Perhaps then it's no surprise that there were many, many settlements there in Megiddo. Archaeologists believe they found evidence of 20 cities there, one on top of the other. With such a history of destruction, what better picture of a mighty battle than the Hill of Megiddo? Since the prefix Har means hill in Hebrew, Har Megiddo would be the Hill of Megiddo. And we believe that's where Armageddon as a title comes from. If we circle back to the 7 years of conflict that was stirred up by these Midianites, we can perhaps understand the scene we find in Judges 6, verses 11 and 12. Then the angel of the Lord came and sat under the oak that was in Ophrah, which belonged to Joash the Abiezrite, as his son Gideon was beating out wheat in the winepress in order to save it from the Midianites. The angel of the Lord appeared to him and said, "The Lord is with you, O valiant warrior." Do you think the angel was mocking Gideon when he called him, "O valiant warrior"? That doesn't really make sense in this story. But if we take it at face value, then we've already been told Gideon is ready to fight on behalf of the Lord. That's what this means. But the interesting question arises, if he's so valiant, why is he beating out wheat hidden in the wine press? Why isn't he just beating it out in the open? And this gives more support to this idea the Midianites were not to be trifled with. Even someone loyal to God like Gideon was maybe the most valiant of Israelites, was forced to work in secret for fear of running afoul of these troops. And this is where the story starts to get more familiar to us. Gideon said to him, "Oh my Lord, if the Lord is with us, why then has all this happened to us? And where are all his miracles which our fathers told us about, saying, 'Did not the Lord bring us up from Egypt?' But now the Lord has abandoned us and given us into the hand of Midian." The Lord looked at him and said, "Go in this your strength and deliver Israel from the hand of Midian. Have I not sent you?" He said to him, "O Lord, how shall I deliver Israel? Behold, my family is the least in Manasseh, and I am the youngest in my father's house." But the Lord said to him, "Surely I will be with you, and you shall defeat Midian as one man." Gideon is living in a time where God's miracles only exist in stories told by his father. And so he is cautious when a messenger comes with this command. I think he wants to believe, but how does one recognize the angel of the Lord? And he also shows wonderful humility in verse 15 when he says, "How shall I deliver Israel? Behold, my family is the least in Manasseh, and I am the youngest." But we know that is exactly how God works. When Samuel was sent to the family of Jesse to find and anoint the king of Israel to replace Saul, he was warned to not look at appearances as a man would see them. God chooses his servants by looking at their heart condition. And then there's one of my favorite scriptures, 1 Corinthians 1, 26 through 28. "For consider your calling, brethren. There were not many wise according to the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble, but God has chosen the foolish things of the world to shame the wise, and the weak things of the world to shame the things which are strong. And the base things of the world and the despised God has chosen, the things that are not, so that he may nullify the things that are." The very reasons that made Gideon question his ability to meet the Lord's needs are exactly the things that made him such a perfect choice. Next, Gideon does something quite interesting. Judges 6, verses 17 through 21. "So Gideon said to him, if now I have found favor in your sight, then show me a sign that it is you who speak with me. Please do not depart from here until I come back to you and bring out my offering and lay it before you. And he said, I will remain until you return. Then Gideon went in and prepared a young goat and unleavened bread from an ephah of flour. He put the meat in a basket and the broth in a pot and brought them out to him under the oak and presented them. The angel of the God said to him, take the meat and the unleavened bread and lay them on this rock and pour out the broth. And he did so. Then the angel of the Lord put out the end of the staff that was in his hand and touched the meat and the unleavened bread, and fire sprang up from the rock and consumed the meat and the unleavened bread. Then the angel of the Lord vanished from his sight. We will talk about several aspects of this passage, but first let's focus on verse 17. Show me a sign that it is you who speak with me. Now, how do we read this? Is this doubting the Lord? Is this a lack of faith? If we actually were to believe that, we would expect the Lord to reprimand him. And yet there is no reprimand recorded. Instead, we would suggest that it is caution. Surely, to have the Lord fight on the side of Israel again, as in the stories of old, is something Gideon really desires. I believe he wants to be sure he isn't merely wanting this to be true in his flesh. He's saying, if you really are the messenger of the one true God, just confirm it for me, please. Show me something that could only come from God. The next interesting part is the sign that is used. He prepares a goat and unleavened bread and broth. We think it is not a coincidence that both the goat and the unleavened bread, prepared with an ephah of flour, are symbols used in the sin offering of the temple. And what better thing to offer in this land where God had largely been abandoned? This was a symbol of the righteousness that had been lost and that God wanted to rekindle again in their hearts. There's a picture here of consecration. As Gideon was, we live in a world where God has largely been forgotten. We believe, we try to do what is right in our understanding, and one day he calls to us. We recognize he wants us to willingly serve him. We consider the cost and recognize that it is our desire, and we offer what we have, perhaps though it be little. In the same way, Gideon recognizes his desire to serve the Lord and offers what he has in accordance with the Lord's will. And there's a third component of this that really jumps out. How is the offering handled? The angel of the Lord has him place the meat and unleavened bread on a rock and pour the broth over them, and he then consumes them with fire. Where have we seen an offering like that before? In 1 Kings chapter 18, verses 31 through 35 and verse 38, and for the sake of time, I won't reread it, I'll summarize, but we know of the time when Elijah had them build this altar and he poured a bunch of water over the altar and had it consumed with fire. And so this is a very similar passage. There's a recurring theme here where the Lord wants to make it clear that his miracles are above and beyond the expectations of man. He leaves no room to doubt his involvement. And this applies not only to the consumption of a burnt offering, despite it being drenched in liquid, we'll also see this applies to the means by which Gideon and his men will eventually overcome the Midianites. There's one more piece we want to talk about before we get to the core of the story. We read Judges chapter 6, verses 25 through 31. Now on the same night, the Lord said to him, take your father's bull and a second bull, 7 years old, and pull down the altar of Baal, which belongs to your father, and cut down the Asherah that is beside it. Wait, we're going to highlight this. He's cutting down the altar of Baal, which belongs to his father? That sounds crazy. I don't remember that from the story when I was a kid, right? How does a righteous Gideon come from a family that has an altar to Baal? Now, we're really forced to speculate. There's no answers given. But it seems his father is not particularly invested in Baal. We're going to see proof of that in a minute. So maybe he was grudgingly allowing family members or servants to build the altar. Maybe he was trying to avoid the wrath of the Midianites. It's really difficult to say. But let's see how his father reacts. Build an altar to the Lord, your God, on the top of this stronghold in an orderly manner. Take a second bull and offer a burnt offering with the wood of the Asherah, which you will cut down. Then Gideon took 10 men of his servants and did as the Lord had spoken to him. And because he was too afraid of his father's household and the men of the city to do it by day, he did it by night. When the men of the city arose early in the morning, behold, the altar of Baal was torn down, and the Asherah, which beside it, was cut down, and the second bull was offered on the altar which had been built. They said to one another, "Who did this thing?" And when they searched about and inquired, they said, "Gideon, the son of Joash, did this thing." Then the men of the city said to Joash, "Bring out your son that he may die, for he has torn down the altar of Baal, and indeed he has cut down the Asherah which was beside it." But Joash said to all who stood against him, "Will you contend for Baal, or will you deliver him? Whoever will plead for him shall be put to death by morning. If he is a god, let him contend for himself, because someone has torn down his altar." There are more details here than we really have answers for, and perhaps it's an interesting further topic of study, but some of this is very clear. In destroying these altars to Baal, Gideon is accomplishing two things. He's taking the first steps in cleansing the land of idolatry. He's making a statement to the locals who have been violating the commandment to have no other gods before Jehovah. And he is no doubt provoking the Midianites as well. He's also cutting down a pagan grove of trees and using this to create an altar to the Lord on which those two bulls were offered. My favorite part of this passage, though, is the response of his father when the townspeople come for Gideon in the morning. "If he is a god, let him contend for himself." Essentially, if Baal is so great, well, can't he punish Gideon? That really doesn't sound like a man who believed in worshiping Baal, right? So I don't get the impression his father was invested in this, but he was not exactly fighting it either. So Gideon taking on the Midianites, we come to the really familiar part of this story, the bit that we all learned in Sunday school, the part that most readily comes to mind. "Then all the Midianites and the Amalekites and the sons of the east assembled themselves and crossed over and camped in the valley of Jezreel," which, remember, is also the valley of Megiddo. "So the spirit of the Lord came upon Gideon, and he blew a trumpet, and the Abiezrites, his own clan members, were called together to follow him. He sent messengers throughout Manasseh, and they also were called together to follow him. And he sent messengers to Asher, Zebulun, and Naphtali, and they came up to meet him." It seems his provocation in destroying the pagan sites had its intended effect. The enemies of Israel have all gathered together in the valley of Megiddo, or Jezreel, and he calls all the local tribes to his aid. A quick glance at a map of the division of the land leads to an interesting question. In this part of the country, there were five of the tribes living closely together: Asher, Issachar, Manasseh, Naphtali, and Zebulun. And yet, we're told he only called four of these. Why was not Issachar mentioned? We actually don't have answers. There's a lot of questions here. We do have some speculation. Maybe Issachar was completely occupied by the Midianites and couldn't mobilize. I don't really love that answer, but that has been suggested. Or possibly all the men of Issachar already knew, because the Abiezrites and the locals were already in that territory. Perhaps. One thing that is important to highlight is that the call went out to these four or maybe five regions, and men from all of these areas answered the call. So even though the nation had fallen away, there were those ready to heed the call and fight for the land and the Lord. They were individual tribes, and yet they were still a nation. And this is another nice picture for us. As they were, we are all individuals, and yet we're all part of one group that follows the Lord. And then there is Gideon putting out the fleece. Judges 6, verses 36 through 40. "Gideon said to God, 'If you will deliver Israel through me as you have spoken, behold, I will put a fleece of wool on the threshing floor. If there is dew on the fleece only and it's dry on the ground, then I will know that you will deliver Israel through me as you have spoken.' And it was so. Then he arose early the next morning and squeezed the fleece. He drained the dew from the fleece, a bowl full of water. Then Gideon said to God, 'Do not let your anger burn against me that I may speak once more. Please let me make a test once more with the fleece. Let it now be dry only on the fleece, and let there be dew on the ground.' God did so that night, for it was dry only on the fleece, and dew was on all the ground." Didn't Gideon already have an earlier sign? Was it not enough for him that the Lord consumed his offering of a goat and broth and unleavened bread? This can be a challenging passage to explain if we interpret his request as indecision or hesitance to follow the Lord. But as before, if he was doing this from an incorrect heart attitude, we would expect a rebuke from the Lord, and yet we don't see such a thing. So the proposal is that there's an alternate explanation. Instead of uncertainty in God's plan, maybe what was really happening is Gideon was uncertain about that he was taking the right action in favor of God's plan. The first request was to make sure his understanding was aligned with the Father's. The second was to be sure he was reading the sign correctly. A wet fleece was not completely unnatural in the way a fire consuming his early offering would have been. When we're unsure of his leading, there's nothing incorrect about seeking to confirm our understanding. If Gideon's motivation was from a pure heart and with the intent of better understanding the Lord's will, that is a lesson for us on how we ought to approach our Heavenly Father. When we consider our action of putting out the fleece we sometimes use to describe our process as we attempt to understand his will, in what manner are we doing this? Are we asking about whether or not we should take that job or buy that house? Are we doing so with the focus on spiritual concerns? When we seek his guidance and direction, it should be things like, should I consecrate my life in his service? Or should I take on this witnessing task? Is this service I wish to offer going to allow me to better glorify his name? When we're attempting to preach the gospel, we know in our hearts that it is the right general course, but perhaps the decision of when or where or how is where we feel we need direction. And we also want to point out that Gideon had an army of 32,000 men and an order from God to destroy the Midianites. But still, he asked for direction. Sometimes knowing what you should be doing is not the same as knowing how the Lord wants you to accomplish it. It's also interesting to note that God did not reveal the next step of his plan to Gideon until after Gideon had confirmed and truly felt he understood God's will. God waited until Gideon was in the right position and frame of mind to hear and believe and understand what would be asked of him. And this is important because by human estimation, the next instructions would seem to be folly. If we compare the number in the respective armies, we see the Midianites totaled around 135,000 men, and the Israelites totaled 32,000. So the Israelites were outnumbered by greater than 4-1. And yet we read in Judges chapter 7, verses 2 and 3, the Lord said to Gideon, "The people who are with you are too many for me to give Midian into their hands. For Israel would become boastful, saying, 'My own power has delivered me.' Now therefore come, proclaim in the hearing of the people, saying, 'Whoever is afraid and trembling, let him return and depart from Mount Gilead.'" So 22,000 out of the 32,000 departed. So what is God saying here? It seems he is saying, beating those kind of odds is difficult and would be impressive. But even then, it's still too easy for the Israelites to make themselves think that they did it under their own power. I mean, I think we perhaps even see that to this day. God would not permit that. This is not unlike the consumption of Gideon's sacrifice or the consumption of Elijah's sacrifice. When God is going to display his power, he's going to make sure you know it is him. This calls to mind Ezekiel chapter 38. We won't read it in its entirety, but I will summarize. It's the prophecy of Gog coming from the north, bringing many nations with them to advance against Israel. And in verse 16, he says, "And you will come up against my people Israel like a cloud to cover the land. It shall come about in the last days that I will bring you against my land so that the nations may know me when I am sanctified through you before their eyes, O Gog." This is another place where God will make his presence known in such a way that none will be able to doubt his involvement. Do we ever fall into this trap? Is it possible we encounter challenges where we need the Lord's assistance, but then afterwards we allow our flesh to rationalize and say, "Well, that wasn't so bad. I guess I was able to handle it." You might say the greatest challenge in those moments is to recognize God's assistance when it is subtle. But in the case of Gideon, he is not going to permit it to be subtle. He will not permit them to miss the fact that it is entirely God's intervention that is delivering them from the Midianites. And just as we grow spiritually and we recognize more and more his leading, as we have continued experience with it and as our faith grows through those experiences, so it was with Gideon. First, he had to believe that the Lord had called upon him to be the tool that destroyed the Midianites. Then he had to believe that this army was the Lord's will. And then he had to whittle down the numbers. First, when 22,000 departed because they were afraid, and then the Lord said to Gideon, "The people are still too many. Bring them down to the water, and I will test them for you." I'm going to be abbreviating because we're already running out of time, but it shall be that he of whom I say, this one shall go with you, he will go with you, but everyone of whom I say, this one shall not, he shall not. So he brought them down to the water, and he separated them, as we know, to those who lapped with their tongue and those who brought it to their mouth. And those who lapped, putting their hands to their mouth, were 300 men, but all the rest knelt. And he claimed only those 300 to be the 300 with Gideon. Now, there were two purposes served in this final reduction. Most obviously, the numbers were reduced a final time in order to make God's part in this unmistakable. However, those who cupped the water in their hands were also displaying a practicality and watchfulness, which identified them as worthy of the greater task that would be set before them. This required alertness, discipline, and trust in their leader. You might think that after the various signs and interactions Gideon had with God through his mouthpiece, that Gideon would have been sufficiently ready to take on the Midianites. But we read that Gideon's faith was strengthened once more when he was encouraged to sneak into the camp of the enemy. But if you are afraid to go down with Purah, your servant, to the camp. And I'm going to summarize the important part that we want to highlight here. Is he came into the camp and he heard a man relating a dream to his friend that a loaf of barley bread was tumbling in the camp of Midian, and it came to the tent and struck it so that it fell and turned it upside down. And his friend replied, this is nothing less than the sword of Gideon, the son of Joash, a man of Israel. God has given Midian and all the camp into his hand. Can you imagine what this must have been like? How does a conversation like this come to pass inside the enemy camp? This is a camp that outnumbered the Israelites 4-1 before Gideon sent most of them home. And yet somehow they knew who Gideon is, even though he is apparently the youngest son of the weakest house in Manasseh. And the dream is clearly interpreted as Gideon come to destroy them through the power of God. Just that conversation alone was a miracle. And the rest is very well known. We won't spend a great deal of time on it. We know that they separated into groups of 100 on the three sides, and they blew a trumpet, and they displayed their torches, and they caused terror. And then after they routed them, they summoned assistance from the surrounding regions, and they pursued them and captured and destroyed them. But we do want to focus on the end of the story. When the fighting was over, the Israelites wanted to appoint Gideon as their ruler and his son after him. They were essentially trying to establish a king. But Gideon said, I will not rule over you, nor shall my son rule over you. The Lord shall rule over you. He did, however, take an earring from each as spoil and melted it down and constructed an ephod from the gold, placing it in Ophrah. And it should not surprise any of us that as with the golden calf in the wilderness, once again, they started to worship it. I think one lesson there for us is that when you are around sin and falsehood your entire life, it's easy to underestimate the power it holds over your decisions. How do they go from a victory of 300 over 135,000 and still find a way to slide back into sin? Yes, it's a slow process. It snuck up on them. With a slight weakening of resolve here and wanting to be a bit more like neighbors over there, we're told that for 40 years there was peace in the land, which was the remainder of Gideon's lifetime. And during that time, he had 70 sons born to his many wives. And then we're told that as soon as he died, verse 33, the Israelites returned to the worship of Baal. Nor did they show loyalty to his family, despite the good he had done for Israel. So we've covered a lot of ground here, brethren. I just want to summarize a few points. As Israel floundered during the period of the judges, lacking leadership, so we recognize the world floundering today. But we have a hope that one day the great judge and king over all will lead us. The Lord is calling us, just as he called to Gideon. He wants willing servants to be molded and shaped into tools to be used by him. And just like tools, we have no value without the master that puts us to use. 3, when we seek his direction in our lives and put out the fleece, it's important we do it for the right reasons. We don't need to seek his will for worldly concerns, but rather for spiritual concerns. We do well to remember that his strength is made perfect in weakness, and so we work to serve as best we can despite our obvious faults, knowing and trusting that our only job is to show up and to do with all our might whatever our hands find to do. And lastly, we should remember how easy it is to fall away. even for those that were present at such a miraculous victory. When we're surrounded by error and the temptations of the flesh on a daily basis, it takes vigilance to maintain our path in the narrow way. So while this is a story we all know well, I hope some of you enjoyed revisiting the details as I did, and I hope I've called to mind for you some things that you had not previously considered, or things perhaps you'd forgotten. We're grateful to our Father for his leading. Amen.